Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking with Susie Davis. Now she's a speaker, co-founder of Austin Christian Fellowship. She's a wife, she's a mother. She's also an author of a number of books, and today I'm talking with her about the book Dear Daughters, Love Letters to the Next Generation. Susie, welcome to LifeQuest.
Gosh, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Why, for you, was this an important book at this time?
Well, I have two grown daughters. I have a son, too, who's now married, so I have a daughter-in-law. And these letters actually started as little online letters I was writing to my girls when they went off to college.
Okay.
And I had such a huge response that I started actually a podcast called Dear Daughters, and then I wrote this book. But it all started for me when I was making sandwiches for my my kids' high school friends and just, you know, across the kitchen counter. I just found that young people wanted wisdom from someone who is hopefully a little wiser and a few steps ahead. And that didn't stop when they were in high school. It actually got more pronounced when they were in college and then off raising their families, getting married and that. So it just started as something organic. And it seems that a lot of young women want a mentor.
And a lot of young people will listen to someone who isn't mom or dad better.
Yeah. That's true, too. And it's funny because that's something that I often see women who have raised families and then their kids leave and they feel a little lonely and sad. And I say, you know what? A mother's job is never over.
Yeah.
If you have a heart that's big enough for other women that or daughters that aren't your own, it's an opportunity to be in relationship with these other young women that want someone to just listen to their story and ask them questions and be interested about their lives.
People, adults, sometimes have forgotten they were teenagers and younger, and I think they don't realize that young people have anxieties and they have worries and they worry about all kinds of things. Early in your book, you talk about when you were 14 years old, a traumatic event happened to you which affected your anxiety level for a long time.
Yeah, I was 14 years old when I witnessed one of my classmates murder my teacher in front of us in school. And this was way back when these things didn't happen, and sadly, you know, they happen all the time. But it created a whirlwind of anxiety in my life that just got bigger and stronger and over a 10-year period, and where I was so fearful. I was waiting for the next foot to fall. And I felt like God loved me, but somehow he had forgotten me. And what I found is you don't have to have witnessed a murder to have that kind of anxiety. You could, you know, have something tragic like your dad abandon your family, or you dealt with a serious illness, and that kind of, you know, what happened to me is I felt like I needed to take care of myself.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people do. When they have anxiety, they feel like it's their job to take care of themselves. But as you and I both know, that's a really big job, because that's
right.
God's job. So, but yeah, I had a lot of anxiety in my 20s and when I first had my first child. And then finally, God, ever the faithful healer, broke it off in a kind of miraculous and crazy way.
But you write, and this is a wonderful conclusion in this chapter, that the problem with all the worry is that it blinds you to the wonder.
True. I mean, I think, and that's actually looking back when I had my son, our first child, I think that I was so worried about him and his safety because of what had happened to me, and I felt like I needed to take care of myself, so of course I needed to take care of him, because what if God missed it on him? That I probably missed a lot of, I know I missed a lot of those early moments just enjoying him and just delighting. And, you know, I know that everybody's life has hardship, but goodness gracious, I'm looking out over a field of Texas wildflowers right now.
Yeah.
And there's so much daily wonder that God has sprinkled all over our lives. There are love notes God's left us, and I want to be alive to the wonder of what, of the beauty and what He's doing in my life with the people and the things and the environment. And I want it for young women too. I want it for my dear daughters. I want them to be free.
Towards the end of that chapter, you say, "Are you ready to practice peace today?" What do you mean by practicing peace?
Practicing peace is waking up and saying, it's really surrendering. It's saying, "God, you know what? You're good. I believe that you're good, and I'm gonna walk in peace today and believe that you're gonna take care of me. And yes, there are bad things that can happen in life, but you're gonna be beside me, and you're gonna heal my heart over it, and you're gonna give me joy on the other side." I mean, that's what God promises, right?
Yeah.
That He'll be with us. So, and that's not just like mumbo jumbo, like sermon talk. That's real stuff that we can experience in our lives.
You point out in the next chapter or so of your book, which is Dear Daughters, Love Letters to the Next Generation, that sometimes, in fact, many times, young people, even in their early 20s, they feel desperately the pressure of planning their life. What are you going to do next? You're 18 years old. You're leaving high school. What about it? And some people do. They're going to college. They know what major they're going to take. Others go through six majors in 4 years. You know, or I had a daughter that college was the best 6 years of her life.
Right.
But anyway, and also pressure for, well, you're this age. You should be getting married. Are you engaged? You know, all this stuff. How do we get people past that? And is it okay to get past it?
Well, I don't know if you've always known exactly what you wanted to do with your life or what you're supposed to do, but I think it's like an ongoing thing, don't you think?
I do.
To constantly. And so I feel like there's a lot of pressure on millennials, especially now, to like figure out what you're supposed to do. And, you know, you graduate from college and you have this big job and you're making all this money.
Yeah.
And in reality, we look historically, I don't think anybody knows exactly what they're doing at 21 or 31 or 41 or sometimes 51. And it's okay if your job changes. It's okay if you're still discovering what you want to do. But the main thing is pulling apart that your work or your vocation is not who you are. Your identity and who you are and your value is in who God made you.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the big thing that women struggle with that I talk to, is just remembering that your job doesn't define your identity. Your identity is stable. It's inside of who God made you to be, and just resting in that.
Yeah. If I can give a personal note here, I remember I was 26 years pastoring, and then I transitioned into Christian radio and moved across the country, Knoxville, Tennessee, and I discovered at some point that I didn't come with any title in the church congregation I was a member of, or anything like that. They knew I did some kind of radio stuff, big deal. But all of a sudden, I discovered they liked me, and I had my Sally Field at the Oscars, you know, "You really do like me." And that was very uplifting, and I had wasted a lot of years worrying about that.
Right. And you said, how old were you when you discovered that?
Oh, wow. 40s.
Right. So I think like that's like your system, you know, to give someone rest and knowing like, oh my gosh, you don't have to have it all together by the time you're 25 years old or 35 years old. Like,
yeah.
It's a constant discovery. I love that you told that story.
Yeah. Chapter 3 is on loving your body. Having four daughters, yeah, and I've known a lot of ladies in capacities as pastors and friends and all that sort of thing, and no matter how attractive they may be, there is something about themselves that they feel isn't as good as it could be.
Right. Well, you know what, and I, like, please introduce me to the woman who's never struggled with body image. I want to meet her, and she needs to write a big book for the rest of us, but I remember, you know, I've always struggled, and when my youngest daughter was like 3 years old, I was getting her ready for a bath, and I was about to pop her in the bathtub, and there were bubbles, and she was standing by the edge of the bathtub, and I looked at her, and I was like, oh my gosh, she's the darlingest thing I've ever seen. Her whole naked body was standing there, and I feel like I heard a God whisper, and it was like, she looks just like you. And I was like, oh my gosh, why do I not have that kind of adoration, that appreciation for my own body that I have for my daughter?
Yeah.
And it was then that I started sharing that story with other women who struggled too. And I think it's such a big compliment to God when we look at our bodies and we're in awe of what he's done instead of we're disgusted. And the other thing I tell women is, like, you live with yourself longer than anybody else.
Yep.
So you might as well like yourself. You might as well love yourself. You might as well. And if you have to do hard work to get to that place, whether it's therapy or talk to somebody or just talk to a spiritual mom and just work that stuff out. But, like, go ahead and, like, love the body that God has given you and appreciate it in the way that you would. You know, I talk about awe. You look at the ocean and you're like, oh, my gosh.
Right.
That's amazing. Well, I would think God would be so pleased if we looked at ourselves that way and we're like, gosh, I'm pretty amazing.
Yeah.
In the healthiest, God-centered sort of way,
mm-hmm.
not in a weird, you know, narcissistic
yeah.
way. But, yeah, I think we need to love ourselves. We need to love our bodies. And one of the things I tell dear daughters to do is find a picture of your baby self and put it in a place where you can look at it and remember how darling you were when you were a baby. You're still that same girl.
In chapter 4, you talk about the relationship between a woman, a daughter, and her father, and how's that of influences. And I remember meeting a couple of sisters, much older than I was. I said, you know, God is like father. Did not go over well, because father hadn't been a wonderful father to them. But regardless if he is or isn't, it does affect our relationship with our Heavenly Father, right?
Yeah, and I bet you could speak to that. I mean, you've had four girls that have watched you, and how important that relationship is, and if there's a way for it to be healthy and
yeah.
whole, that's so good. But we can't always have that kind of relationship with our dad, and I've talked to many young women who struggle to see God as faithful when their fathers walked out on the family.
Mm-hmm.
Or they struggle to see God as a provider if they don't have a dad that's provided. But I think just being aware of that, and like I said, doing the hard work to get on the other side of it and realize that no matter how great your dad was, he wasn't perfect. But your Heavenly Father is perfect, and he is all good. So he has all good intentions for your life. He has all pure love for your life, and he's going to be there. And that's something that I believe, not just women, I think men and women
mm-hmm.
need to get to, that idea that God is who he says he is. He's a good father. He's a provider. He's a healer. He's a protector. Those are the things that God the Father is.
Chapter 6, you title, On Feeling Small. And you have at one point there a statement, it's dangerous to judge your value but by what other people are doing. And I thought about that. You know, you look out and other people's kids, boy, they're just wonderful, aren't they? And parenting, I mean, my oldest daughter, she's busy with the kids doing everything from soccer to violin to cello, whatever, right?
Right.
And I was just glad to help them get ready for school and do their homework for them or whatever. But I'm saying we do judge our parenting, our style, our lifestyle, everything else by other people, don't we?
Yes, and now with Instagram, we can do it just the minute we wake up and
oh, yes.
watch it all day until we get asleep at night and feel completely worthless.
Yeah.
But the truth is everybody's life has those small moments where you're folding the laundry or, you know, cleaning out the garage.
I mean, mm-hmm.
we all have times where we're stuck in traffic and we feel like our life isn't as big and beautiful as the ones we see on Instagram or Facebook. But it's I think that really in the context of the book it's in that chapter is that inside of those moments we have the opportunity to be with God and to do little things for him. And that's inside of those little moments we have an opportunity for worship. So that's really the creative look at it, is instead of wondering why we're not doing big important things,
yeah.
really start, it's that back to that idea of the wonder and the awe in your own daily life. Like, love your one beautiful life. Like, look for those moments where you can just be with and enjoy and actually have the simplicity of doing those small things and finding joy inside of them.
If you just tuned in, I'm talking with Susie Davis. She's written a book called Dear Daughters, Love Letters to the Next Generation. On what we were just talking about, Susie, this kind of came home to me as I was typing out that work of fiction, The Christmas Letter, in which we discuss about how wonderful life is and our children. And then you realize, well, okay, that's what people expect, but it isn't the way it always is portrayed.
Right.
Well, I was then going to go to, I think, a very important chapter for people, and that is this concept of transitions, living life wholeheartedly, and yet there's these transitions, whether it's death or the kids, the empty nest thing. All those types of significant changes can make a difference in our life, sometimes positively, but sometimes not.
Yeah, and transitions are usually a transition means something's dying before something's born. And I think that the one thing about transitions is that we wish that they could just be happy. Mm-hmm. But there's always, if something's dying, there usually needs to be a grief over it. And grief is a normal and healthy part of life. And when we neglect to realize that, you know, something's making us sad, we can carry that around. We can push it down and carry it around and become unhealthy people. So in these normal life transitions, like I think for me, my most recent is, you know, all my kids getting married and leaving the nest.
Right.
Well, I grieved that. And it wasn't that I wasn't happy about mm-hmm. what they were doing, because I had prayed for their one beautiful life and marry these people, and now we have a grandson, but I miss them. You know, and I think many women my age feel that way. And if I had acted like everything was okay and I didn't recognize the sadness too, that would have made me an unhealthy person, and I would have fallen into becoming a mother-in-law, you know, and who knows how unhealthy. You know, I mean, but so it's okay to grieve it, and you need to have safe people to grieve with, and that's why it's always good. I have a spiritual mama, someone that's older than me who's mentoring me, mm-hmm. and I'm 55. I think we all need people a little bit ahead, and then, you know, they're helping us, and then we need to reach down and help someone a few steps behind.
In your last chapter, there's a quote here that a contented Christian, being sweetly captivated under the authority of the Word, desires to be wholly at God's disposal. St. Paul mentioned that, too, in those terms. I've learned to be content in all things. And yet, there were a lot of issues in his life. What define contentedness in some kind of present-day sense.
Well, for me, I think of my mother. That chapter actually talks about my mom. Mm-hmm. And she's a deeply contented woman. I've watched her through so many seasons of her life.
Right.
Contentment is accepting with gratitude the new places that God is taking you. In my mind, that is, and we just talked about transitions, but it's moving into the next new season that God has for us with, I think of my mother, she has so much grace, mm-hmm. and she has a real peace about where she is. She's not longing for what was behind, she's not yearning for what's ahead, but she's just really able to enjoy right where she is, and I strive to be like that.
Tell our listeners, Susie, about the format of the book. You've got these pages that are blank except for lines where I'm assuming somebody can write. What's that all about?
Yes, Emily, I had the opportunity to sign a woman's book who had already started writing in it in the margins, and it just almost made me cry. I was so happy. But the reason that there are journal lines is because I want you to write in the book. I ask a lot of questions in every chapter, and I want it to be something that someone is thoughtful about their life. I want the book to feel like I'm sitting across from you and we're having coffee and we're just talking about life. And then I would love for the book to become a bridge for women to share, for a younger woman and an older woman to read a chapter and just talk about it and think about the questions and discuss what's going on in their lives.
The book is Dear Daughters, Love Letters to the Next Generation. Susie, where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
Any bookseller online or your local, hopefully your local independent bookseller too. And then, you know, Amazon, of course, it's at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Susie, thanks so much for being with us on LifeQuest.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful.
My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.